Up front next, life-threatening impact. That's how officials tonight are describing Hurricane Ian's power, on track to make a direct hit to Florida. Nearly 2 million people right now are under mandatory evacuation orders. Plus, Russia with a new nuclear warning tonight as it reports the first results from that staged referendum. Is Putin on the cusp of his most dangerous move? And a story you'll see first out front. We're going to introduce you to a group of women learning to fire a gun for the first time. They say they don't feel safe in their cities anymore, and they are not Republicans. Let's go out front. And good evening. I'm Erin Burnett. Out front tonight, bracing. The state of Florida, that's the right word for what's happening there tonight, bracing and preparing tonight for a direct hit as Hurricane Ian picks up speed. The storm, called the storm of a lifetime, is now a dangerous Category 3. Winds are 120 miles an hour. These are live pictures out of the Florida Keys, where conditions are quickly deteriorating, as you can see. You certainly can't even make sense of the horizon there. Tropical storm winds and a damaging storm surge are battering the island chain. That is tonight. Now let me show you Sombrero Beach. That is in Marathon, Florida. There you see the winds already hitting those palm trees. Residents are being told to take cover. Tornado warnings there have already begun. And this is all as Ian is not even there, right? Ian is still growing in strength, feeding on those incredibly warm waters of the Gulf, the warmest in the Atlantic. This is a satellite image of the storm's eye. It is an impressive eye, a huge eye, we understand, and hurricane force winds now extend 40 miles from that eye. As the wind field expands, forecasters say the storm could make landfall in the next 24 hours. But that's 24 hours where it can get stronger and stronger, feeding off that hot water. Right now, Sarasota and Fort Myers are bracing for a storm surge that would be historic at 12 feet. They say it could be that or higher. And in Tampa, officials fear what they are calling a worst-case scenario, which is damaging winds, life-threatening foot storm surge across a city that has not been hit by a major hurricane in more than 100 years. So right now, 2.5 million people across Florida have been told to evacuate. That's just Florida. Georgia is already declaring a state of emergency in anticipation of the storm. And we are now seeing the power of this storm striking land. This is, as we said, we're still right 24 hours away from striking the U.S. But in Cuba, the storm passing through with a path of destruction. Look at the flooding there. Havana in darkness tonight. We have team coverage. I want to begin in Tampa, Florida, with Ryan Young and Tom Sater at our weather center, at CNN headquarters. So, Tom, let's just start with the forecast here. Okay. Where are we as, you know, we're watching that swirl? Tell me where we are and about that strength here that you see in that eye.
Well, what's happening, Erin, and what has been happening is as the storm's pressure drops, the winds increase. Now, it takes a while for the winds to respond to that pressure drop, but it means it's getting stronger. It's not only getting stronger, it's getting larger in size. Hurricane force winds now extend outward a good 40 miles on each side. So that's an 80-mile swath, and it's going to get wider as it approaches. Tropical storm force winds extend outward 150 miles in each direction. That's 300 miles. That also will get bigger. Now, we just had our first tropical storm wind in Key West, 40 miles per hour sustained, a 60-mile-per-hour gust. However, if you want to know about timing of tropical storm force winds, here you go. Purple is your greatest possibility. This is 8 p.m., so Key West is in this. Now, you go from Sarasota over toward Lake Okeechobee, that's 2 in the morning. So you've got this entire region of Southwest Florida that's going to see overnight period of tropical storm force winds, and it just continues and toward Wednesday. Now, when it comes to the track, and this has been interesting because there's a big change in the last 24 hours that we've seen this movement from the west to the east, dropping that system down southward. In fact, tracks come from the National Weather Service every 6 hours. In the last 4 runs, it has dropped each time for a total of 65 miles. Doesn't Wow. sound like much, but that 65 miles is saving Tampa Bay because yesterday, we thought it was going to hang off the coast, slow down, and just kick that surge at them for 36 to 48 hours. Their surge forecast was 5 to 10. It's now 4 to 6. In fact, as the storm hits south of them, for a while, as it spins counterclockwise, that wind or that surge and water in the bay will recede and go down. But to the south, now we're seeing the increase here where it's dangerous from Sarasota southward to Bonita Springs, and that's where you're going to see a tremendous amount. We're starting to see tornado warnings, a tornado watch for this area until 5 in the morning. That's an incredible amount of time. You never see that. Watches and effects, but this is the Peace River. already they've had above average rainfall the last 2 weeks. There are several gauges on the Peace River that are already above flood stage. And now this area of Charlotte Harbor is going to see the highest surge. And it goes all the way up miles back in toward the Peace River where it's going to back everything up. So we're not just talking about flooding in every inlet and in the harbor, but in all these rivers that have already seen excessive rainfall the last couple of days. And there's much more rain on the way. Here's a change. How about 20 to 30 inches north of the system? And that includes Tampa Bay. So they're not out of this. Inland flooding is going to be just as bad.
20 to 30 inches. I mean, it's staggering to even imagine that. All right, Tom, thank you very much. I'm amazing. It's interesting. Tom saying, you know, 65 miles doesn't sound like a lot, but it does sound like a lot to me to think about that a storm track could change that dramatically in just a matter of hours. But this storm is unprecedented in many ways and intensifying. Florida residents are scrambling to make their final preparations as they prepare for landfall. Ryan Young is out front.
Hurricane Ian slamming western Cuba this morning with winds over 120 miles per hour. The Category 3 storm left a path of widespread destruction, flooding and cutting power to more than a million people. The storm flattening buildings and turning roads into rivers, now gaining significant strength as it makes its way over warm water in the Gulf and heads directly for Florida. Nearly 3 million people are under evacuation orders along the western coast of the state.
We're coming by and letting everybody know that you're in a mandatory evacuation situation.
The Tampa Bay area in its final hours of hurricane preparations. Tampa Bay police making last-ditch efforts to warn residents in flood-risk zones to leave now.
It's a reinforcement to let them know that, hey, you're in an area where you need to evacuate. And so we know this thing is going to be hitting the state directly sometime tomorrow evening. You still have some time, but that time is rapidly running out.
Serious warnings to residents here, this vulnerable area expecting to be in the crosshairs of Hurricane Ian.
We have over 120 miles of coastline just in the city of Tampa.
Schools and businesses are closing across the state as the storm is predicted to cause water damage like none before.
You're talking about 10 or 15 inches of rain on top of the surge. That's unprecedented. No infrastructure is built for that.
With this hurricane, a direct hit isn't necessary to cause severe flooding. The slow-moving storm is predicted to stall just off the coast of Tampa Bay starting Wednesday evening.
It's going to be in our rivers. It's going to be in our streams. It's going to be in our canals. It's going to be in our stormwater drains and ditches.
Sandbag locations around Tampa close today at 2 o'clock. Residents doing what they can before heading out.
Well, we're late, but we think that if it is a storm surge issue, we will try to seal the openings of the house.
Former Florida Congressman Jim Davis and his wife aren't taking chances. They're prepping their house and getting out.
I'm not a very good gambler, and it's a bit of a gamble if you don't take it seriously.
Yeah, you can understand why people are worried about the storm surge. Look behind me at the hospital here. They put up the barricades here to make sure they protect this hospital. Sometimes when it has a heavy rain, they are affected. This is a level one trauma center. Now look from above at how close they are to the water. The residents here tell me they love being this close to the water. In fact, there's over 130 miles of coastline in the greater Tampa area. So you understand there's an affection with it. But right now, they are so concerned about storm surge. When we were out with those police officers, as they went door to door, we actually had someone in that community tell us they have nowhere to go. They do not want to go to a shelter because they don't want to go through that. But at the same time, they understand and are fearful about the idea of staying in their home during the storm and whatever's coming next. Aaron?
All right. Thank you very much. I want to go to Shannon Weiner now, Emergency Management Director from Monroe County. That includes the Florida Keys. So, Shannon, the storm passing west of the Keys tonight, what are you experiencing so far?
So, currently, we are experiencing tropical storm force conditions. On the low end, as far as sustained winds, in the middle and lower Keys, we're looking at storm conditions of winds of somewhere in the range of 40 to 50 miles per hour. And we've had a few heavy gusts in Key West in the 60 to 70 mile per hour range. Lots of rain. It has been raining now off and on all day. Some areas we've officially recorded, 6 inches of water plus. So we are definitely feeling the tropical storm effects here in Monroe County.
And how bad do you expect it to get here overnight?
We do expect it to worsen overnight. We are beginning to see a few power outages throughout the lower Keys, some down trees in residential areas, So we are very closely monitoring the situation as we move through the evening and early morning hours.
So I know you've asked everyone to stay off the roads, to be in a safe structure by afternoon. Of course, we have video, people out in the water watching the waves crash. What do you say to them, to anyone who is not heeding the warnings at this point? I mean, we can see them here right by the water's edge.
Yes. So, you know, we've experienced many tropical storms for here in the Florida Keys. So we are well aware of the impacts. And there are those people that do like to enjoy the weather up to the very last minute. But we really do urge them to seek safe shelter with family or friends, particularly after nightfall and particularly this evening as we see the conditions continue to deteriorate.
All right, Shannon, thank you very much. I appreciate it, of course, as Florida prepares for the onslaught of this storm. Next, one of Putin's top allies with a new nuclear warning tonight. As Russia touts the results of its sham referendum, we're going to take you live to Ukraine for the latest. Plus, Trump just sidelined his newest attorney, the lawyer who was hired to lead his defense in the Mar-a-Lago classified documents case. Benched. How come? And Anderson Cooper is out front tonight on why he's sharing his most personal feelings about loss and grief as a deeply, deeply personal person, choosing to share that with all of us. Now tonight, a dangerous tipping point. The former Russian president and a still very close Putin ally, Dmitry Medvedev, coming out today with a stark prediction, and it's this. He's saying the U.S. and NATO won't do anything if Russia uses nuclear weapons in Ukraine because, Medvedev says, quote, the demagogues across the ocean and in Europe are not going to die in a nuclear apocalypse. So basically, Russia can use nukes with impunity in Ukraine and no one will do anything about it because they don't want to have a massive strategic intercontinental ballistic missiles nuke fest. Russian state media, meantime, is claiming that the sham referendums that ended tonight in Russian-occupied regions of Ukraine show that huge majorities support joining Russia. Shocker. And Ukrainian officials saying that this is all a cover for Russia to now draft Ukrainian men into the Russian military to be used as cannon fodder. Ben Wiedemann is out front. Now, he is in a town that has been partially liberated by Ukrainian soldiers. I do want to warn you that what you're going to see is disturbing, but we feel important.
The bodies of dead Russian soldiers are scattered around the town of Pisky-Radkivsky, killed far from home in what the Kremlin chooses to call a special military operation, but it's a war by any other name. A war into which many more Russians will be thrown now that the so-called partial mobilization has begun, and who may well meet a similar end.
This is a bank document found on one of the soldiers. The soldier is from St. Petersburg, and he was born on the 30th of September, 2001. He died 3 days before his birthday.
The charred remnants of Russian armor are scattered around town. Outgoing artillery pursues an army once considered one of the most powerful on Earth. An army that abandoned tanks aplenty, many in working order. Dmitry and his crew are tinkering with one such tank fresh from the battlefield. It has minimal breakage, he says. I can turn it on now without any problems. Sure enough, its motor roars to life. When they run away, they lose not only the tanks, says Oleksandr, but also the ammunition, and the next day it's all used against them. This tank almost ready to go back into action. Pisky-Radkivsky lies just north of the Donbas region, which after sham referenda, President Vladimir Putin plans to annex to Russia. Yet few here have fond memories of life under Russia's sway. Stanislav is cutting sheet metal to put over the shattered windows of his sister's home. There was looting in spring, he recalls. They were taking everything. Down the road, Varvara and Raisa are back to what they did throughout the Russian occupation. Just sitting here, says Varvara, they didn't bother us. But Raisa found them annoying.
Nazis,
she says. They always ask, where are the Nazis? The Russians have left or lie dead in the dirt. Lives wasted or nothing.
Ben, it's impossible to imagine what it was like to see that. You talk about that boy, 19 or 20 years old with the bank document. And for you, what is it like as you have covered so much of this war to walk through a town like that and see dead bodies of Russian boys all over the place?
I mean, it was just shocking the number of dead Russians we saw. We counted at least 22 bodies, and we were really in that town only about 50 minutes to an hour, and we really didn't even get a complete look at the situation there. But just to add some more news for you, this city, Kharkiv, where we are now, just about 5 hours ago, came under Russian missile fire. About five missiles landed, one of them just about 600 yards from we are now. It took a electronic substation out, and the city, much of the city, is completely without electricity. In fact, I can see just a couple lights in the background. Perhaps those are from generators. But this just gives you an idea that despite the fact that the Russians are losing ground in this part of Ukraine, they still have the ability with their long-range missiles to cause serious damage.
Yeah, absolutely. Aaron? And important to, as they are trying to solidify, whatever control they have over certain occupied areas, that they are still trying to attack Kharkiv. Ben Wiedemann, thank you so much for that powerful report. I want to go to now retired Army Major General James Spider Marks. General, what's your reaction when you see that? Obviously, that town that Ben spent, he said, less than an hour and is extremely close to the line that Putin now is going to define as the line of Russia, even though, of course, it isn't. It was a fake referendum. It wasn't real, and it's not the real border. But that's what he's going to try to say. And that they're going through now, and there's literally just, as the Russians retreated, they certainly did not take their dead. It seems to be littered with Russian bodies. Ben wasn't even counting, but at least 22 that he saw just lying there.
Yeah, what this really tells you is what we've seen the Russians doing for the past 7 months. Look, there's no humanity in this fight. There's no sense of leadership, as we've described. There's an absence in terms of any type of a professional ethos. And you can imagine the resistance, and we're seeing the pictures of the resistance to this mobilization that President Putin has put in place.
Yes.
Because it's obvious what can possibly happen. They're going to a fight where the Russian soldier is only fighting for a paycheck and essentially a bucket of lies, and the Ukrainians are fighting for their sovereignty.
And the images we've seen are stunning, right? You can see them from space, satellite images of 10-mile-long lines at the border. The expectation now that those borders could be forcibly closed, sort of a panic of men trying to leave the country. And you've seen criticism from quarters that we've not ever seen criticism. That's the satellite line there on the Russian-Georgian border that we have up on the screen. A Russian television anchor who has been one of the biggest proponents of everything Putin's done, including advocating for all sorts of nuclear conflagration, actually criticized in a bizarre way. Let me play it.
The idiots out there who are calling up musicians or individuals with a million illnesses or students, despite the clearly defined exemptions laid out in the decree, not only should they be punished, but they should be the first to be sent to the front lines. If anyone wishes to discredit our Supreme Commander-in-Chief, I'd strongly advise against it.
Okay, so he criticizes, and of course, ultimately, the only blame for any of that would be on the ultimate commander-in-chief, but then says, I'm not doing that. But it is rare, nonetheless, to hear that, and certainly from him, as I said, a person who has been a big proponent of all sorts of nuclear weapons. How significant is that, if at all?
Well, I think it's significant in that what he is saying is the execution of this mobilization, how they're going about it, is completely full of holes. It's not being done very well at all. It's apparent that there isn't a sense of what the top line policy is and how that cascades through the various regions and how it needs to be executed. But what he is doing is he's saying, look, everybody out there is a fool except for Putin. So don't forget that. Putin's in charge. He knows what he's doing. We're surrounded by a bunch of dummies. And this is going to be the result unless we get our act together.
And Spider, what about what Dmitry Medvedev said today, which is NATO, Europe, the U.S., they won't do anything if Russia uses nukes in Ukraine. And they won't do anything because they don't want to have a big international nuclear war because everybody would die. So basically, we can use nukes in Ukraine. Do you think that's true?
Oh, I don't think it's true at all. I mean, the fact is the benefit, the real strategic value of nukes is in their deterrent effect. When you use a nuke, you've lost its effective value. And I would tell you that if a nuke was used, and I can't get into descriptions, whether that's a tactical nuke, low yield, short range, who cares, or if it's a specific Ukrainian target, or if they do it over the Arctic poles someplace as a demonstration, I would guarantee if that took place, sends a very powerful message, there would be a U.S.-led coalition inserted into this fight, led with a coalition of partners from NATO on the ground in Ukraine. They wouldn't cross over into Russia, and they would defeat this Russian military in Ukraine in a short amount of time, probably 96 hours. Putin understands that. He has to understand that.
96 hours. Wow. Spider, thank you very much. I appreciate your time, General.
Thank you, Ryan.
Next, Trump just sidelined his big-time attorney. This was the person supposed to be leading his Mar-a-Lago defense. Why? And a story you will see first out front. We're going to introduce you to a group of women. They are part of a growing trend. They are learning to fire a gun, and they're doing it for the first time. So, why now?
Do you think it's going to make you feel safer?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you have knowledge of stuff, it you know, makes you safer.
Tonight, sidelined. So you're looking on your screen at the former Florida Solicitor General. His name is Chris Keyes, and he is no longer representing Donald Trump in the Mar-a-Lago documents probe. Now, this is according to two sources familiar with the matter. Now, the reason I'm mentioning this is it's actually really surprising because Chris Keyes just joined Team Trump less than a month ago, specifically to work on this issue. And he got a $3 million retainer fee, and he got that up front. So that's pretty incredible. Now, we're told Keyes is expected to remain on Trump's legal team, could do other Trump investigations, maybe, but not on this one. I want to go to Ryan Goodman, the co-editor-in-chief of Just Security and former special counsel at the Defense Department. So, Ryan, they spent weeks looking for the right lawyer in Florida to specifically work on the Mar-a-Lago documents case. Chris Keyes then is that guy. Now, a month later, he's out. I mean, maybe he'll do other things. Maybe this is a gracious way to get him out. I don't know. But what does it tell you?
So it's really remarkable because he was brought in as this kind of heavyweight. They needed somebody with some gravitas and stature in Florida. And so for him to be sidelined at this point with only 4 weeks in and a whole lot of action ahead of us is something remarkable. And he's also, I would say, from what we know, the most competent lawyer around Trump. So it leaves him back in the saddle of these lawyers who have made so many strategic and tactical errors.
And so now, even if he is on board, this is a guy who's sidelined in favor of people who are not experienced or may not. So who knows if he'd even be willing? I mean, who knows, right? To this whole point of whether he's going to focus on something else. Okay, so that's significant. And in this whole issue of the special documents, you saw something today that stood out to you. And this was about the special master, Judge Deary, appearing to call out Judge Cannon, who was the judge who had ruled in favor of Trump, obviously, in Florida. Tell me what happened.
So this is a bit of a surprise. Just out of nowhere, Judge Deary issued an order in which he said, look, something that just happened, which nobody has really noticed, Judge Cannon has clipped my wings. She has, in amending her initial order, actually taken out my authority to issue interim reports and make recommendations to her. And there's no reason for her to have done that. She was overturned by the 11th Circuit on something completely unrelated, whether he could handle classified documents. And he makes that point as well. So she did reply today within a span of a couple hours, and actually said, no, you have that authority still to issue recommendations and reports as you deem appropriate. But it's a strange dust-up between a special master and the district judge.
And you said that is not a normal back and forth that you would see, but certainly she appeared to back down and to acquiesce to him.
Exactly.
All right, so now the other thing that happened today, start of jury selection in what could be a crucial case. People want to wonder whether Trump will be held responsible and in what way. Look at the images on your screen. This is the Oath Keepers founder, Stuart Rhodes. Four of his top lieutenants, along with he, are being tried over the deadly insurrection. And really, Ryan, for the first time in more than 100 years, you're seeing these charges for seditious conspiracy. And in over a decade, the first time that the DOJ will argue that any group of Americans tried to overturn the government. Now, Rhodes himself is a very interesting figure. He went to Yale Law School. He knows the law. And here he is. How important is this particular case to Trump himself?
So it can turn out to be quite important because, in fact, Rhodes is trying as his defense to argue that they engaged in this scheme on the theory that Trump was going to invoke the Insurrection Act and then call them into action. And that's their defense. The Justice Department actually tried to block them from making the defense. I think the Justice Department just says, let's make it a clean trial. It's about your personal responsibility. Don't try to blame
as
it on anybody
to
else.
On Trump.
Yeah, but if they succeeded in their defense or whatever evidence they produce at the trial, that could be pretty significant because they're pointing the finger at Trump himself.
Well, they're saying the guy who was the leader, the person we were doing this for, is Trump.
That's
which
right.
is what he's saying is not true. So that could be hugely consequential.
Yes.
All right. Ryan Goodman, thank you very much. A lot here, you know, even though obviously the January 6th hearings tomorrow have been postponed because of the hurricane, so much of this continuing, and that selection continues tomorrow. Thank you. Yeah. And next, a story you'll see only out front. More women in the United States learning to fire guns for the first time, and some of them are Democrats.
Do you think you'll feel safer if you're carrying?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
With all the things that you see on the news, like things are happening more.
Plus, Anderson Cooper opening up tonight about his own loss and grief. He's out front. Tonight, soft on crime. Republicans in a number of tough races across the country are trying to tie Democrats to a surge in crime in major cities. Democrat John Fetterman, in one of the most closely watched Senate races, releasing a new ad today, fighting back against his opponent, Dr. Oz, who's calling him dangerously liberal on crime.
I'm a county sheriff, veteran, and Pennsylvanian.
I'm sick of Oz talking about John Fetterman and crime. Here's the truth. John gave a second chance to those who deserved it. Nonviolent offenders, marijuana users.
So people want to make this all about politics. Are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? How do you feel about crime? Of course, the reality is more nuanced. And our David Culver went out to talk to women who are learning to fire a gun for the first time. Now, they lean left politically. And see what he found. They say they don't feel safe.
While Brandy Joseph readies her classroom and safety waivers get signed, we'll set the scene for you. These women, now in their early 50s, are childhood friends from Los Angeles.
And your caliber is right here. It is a .22 caliber.
Their Saturday social, Firearms 101. Perhaps surprising considering most of these women politically lean left.
Do you have some friends who will be totally turned off by this?
Absolutely.
They won't be happy.
Not at all.
How do you deal with that?
Not my problem. That's their choice. Exercising my choice.
You push down and not in.
After a thorough intro, they're off to the firing line.
Phones, I don't want to see them out. I need you to be paying attention to what we're about to do.
We noticed Jamie Beverly paying attention, but seemingly uneasy.
How are you feeling?
Seeing all the guns on the table, I was like, ugh.
Do you think it's going to make you feel safer?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you have knowledge of stuff, it you know, makes you safer.
Would you ever want to carry?
I don't think so.
Rack your slide one time to get your cartridge back. Perfect. Any questions? Nope. Guns down.
LaRanya Day organized this friend's outing with a personal purpose.
Like our society and our climate is changing, and just better to be prepared for your own safety and protection is how we feel.
They are not alone. At Burro Canyon Shooting Park, just east of L.A., we met Jessica Mendez.
I'm a Mexican woman in a same-sex relationship. I need to feel safe. I need to feel protected.
Her wife, Grecia Regalado, at first wanted nothing to do with guns.
Your first experience hearing what we're hearing right now, gunshots, you were not taking it very well.
Yeah, just the sound, the vibrations of each impact, it made me feel very scared.
Be as mechanical as the gun is.
Tom Nguyen began training the couple last year with a focus on self-protection.
The more I educate folks who are formerly anti-gun, the more they actually realize that there's more nuance to it.
Do you see an opening here that perhaps on a national level, the dialogue can happen?
I hope so. And I think the tide's turning. It's absolutely turning because the past 2 years, it's been unprecedented, the types of folks that are buying guns.
While white men have the highest rate of gun ownership in the U.S., one survey showed that in the first half of 2021, roughly 90% of retailers saw a surge in gun sales to African Americans. And about 80% of retailers reported an increase in firearm purchases by Hispanic and Asian Americans.
There you go.
Living in California, a state with some of the toughest gun laws, Jessica tells me she's more comfortable talking about her relationship than about her guns.
I definitely am more closeted in being a gun owner.
Really?
For fear of retaliation.
Do you worry that you're glamorizing or glorifying gun ownership?
It's something that I really, really try not to do it. Even just like wearing shirts that have like guns on them, I don't do that. Because I don't want people to think that it's just like an accessory.
Back on the Fortune Firearms Ranch.
And I love what I do.
Firearms instructor and dealer Brandi Joseph noticing the changing clientele.
There is a huge uptick in female owners. Women are getting trained. Women are caring.
Liberal and conservative.
Liberal and conservative. Yeah.
Data from Harvard found that more than half of new gun owners are likely to be women.
Here to go up, pull your trigger, boom, back to your frame.
Nearly 2 hours into their training, these women ready to pull the trigger.
Slowly pull your trigger. Perfect.
After class, the group seemingly more comfortable.
Is it strange to think for some of you that you know how to load and handle those weapons?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie Beverly.
Yeah, I'm still leery. I don't think I would purchase.
Yeah.
The others ready to be armed.
I just feel liberated.
Yeah. You think you'll feel safer if you're carrying?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
With all the things that you see on the news, like things are happening more in so many public areas, movie theaters, Walmarts, grocery stores. It's like there's no limit now.
It's really incredible. Obviously, you there were doing that piece in California.
Right.
But, you know, there's to the extent that there's a narrative out there that the people who have guns either get them in illegally, you know, the criminal intent,
yeah,
or are some deep south gun-toting Republican, what you're showing is that that's now false.
We have this image, right? And when I heard murmurs about this existing, this unassuming gun owner, it's not until you pull the curtain back and you realize it is so nuanced. It is far more than we could ever imagine. And there is no typical gun owner. And this proves that. I mean, I was talking to some of the folks who were running this Harvard study as well.
Yeah.
And they did further analysis just for us that I got within the past 24 hours. And it showed that in the 2020 election, if you look at those new gun owners, how they voted, 39% voted for Trump, roughly the same exact number voted for Biden. It shows you it's across political lines.
It is across political lines.
And across the country.
Which is a lesson politicians should take away from this.
Yeah,
obviously,
sure.
It's very significant, not just something you can just put people in a box based on their politics.
That's right.
David, thank you so much for that. And next, Anderson. He's got a new podcast about his own loss and grief after the death of his mother. And many of you may have watched it. It's quite transformative. It's resonating with so many people. And he's next to talk about it. And you saw NASA crash a spacecraft into an asteroid right here last night. Now we actually have the incredible new images of the actual impact itself. But tonight, all there is. My friend Anderson Cooper is out front tonight to talk about his new profound podcast that has moved so many because it's about dealing with the loss of those closest to you. Anderson started recording what would become his first podcast while he was packing up the apartment of his mother, Gloria Vanderbilt, after she died. Here's a preview.
I wasn't really surprised by my mom's death, but I was surprised by the loneliness I felt afterward and still feel. She was the last person from the little family that I grew up in, the last person who knew the same stories as me and had the same memories. Now I'm the only one. I feel like a lighthouse keeper on an empty island. And I feel like I need to preserve all that happened because if I don't, my mom and my dad and my brother, the life that we shared and all those moments and all their friends, they'll all just disappear.
And Anderson is with me now. So, you know, I've watched you sort of tapes or parts of this as you've been doing it through your days. Why did you decide to do this now?
My mom died 3 years ago, but I've been going through her stuff even while she was alive. A lot of stuff that belonged to my dad, who died when I was 10, and my brother, who died when I was 21. And I just felt very isolated and alone in this process of just going through all these things for, you know, it's, and I realized just how universal this experience is. This is something all of us either have done already, going through the things of a loved one we've lost, or will have to do. And I started recording because I needed to kind of narrate what I was doing to just make sense of it to myself, and decided that it'd be nice to kind of start a conversation with listeners about this experience that I'm going through and that they're going through, and hearing other people's experiences with loss and grief.
And you've had so much loss. I remember when your mom died, and I was writing you a note, and I said, because I had lost my mother, and there's just that hole in your life. Mm. I said, but how can I write Anderson a note? Because he has experienced so much more loss and greater loss throughout your life.
I'm really winning in the loss game.
but it has, in what way has it sort of defined you? I mean, I guess in a spiritual way.
No, it's without a doubt. I mean, loss, I feel like my life has been shaped by it. I think anybody who loses a parent as a child, my dad was, 50 when he died. I was 10 years old. Yeah. I interviewed Stephen Colbert in episode 2 of the podcast, which is out now. He lost his father and two of his brothers in a plane crash when he was 10. You know, it changes who you are. I am a different person. I mark time as the person I was before my dad's death and after. And that, it was like reset the clocks. It was the new year zero. And I don't want to pass that on to my kids. I want my kids to not have sort of the sense of loss and grief that I've had. I want them to have this lightness and this love and know who their grandparents were and who my brother was, but not have the sadness associated with it.
How much are they a part of this, of you doing this now that you've got these two little boys?
It's a big part of what motivated me to do it. I was trying to think of, like, well, how do I explain to my kids when they're of an age they can understand, like my mom and my dad and their, grandmother and grandfather and my brother. And I thought, I think there's many different ways to do it, but this was one way to kind of start to document just this process and leave my thoughts. I didn't have any recordings of my dad's voice. And one of the things that's been remarkable is I was sent by a man named Charles Ruess, who had done an interview with my dad in 1976, a recording of an interview that they did together. And he sent it to me, and I would listen to it in my office. And it was the first time I heard my dad's voice since I was 10 years old. And it sounded nothing like I remember, but he was talking about my brother and me. And that had such a profound impact on me. I thought, God forbid, if I'm not there for my kids at a certain age, I love the fact that they will have these recordings in this podcast to kind of know what I was doing and sort of talking to them through it.
And you talk about how you knew, it's like I was thinking, we were in London at the Queen's funeral, and you knew your mother was ailing, right? Mm. You knew it was going to come. And yet when it came, it was still unexpected, the impact that it would have on you, that loneliness you would feel. And, you go through in the podcast, you hear the sounds that people hear in the podcast, but for you are a part of your life and your history and your upbringing.
Yeah, the sound of a lock opening up, things in her apartment, all these little sounds that were so part of my life, I wanted to record because they disappear and you forget over time.
So you mentioned Stephen Colbert. It's amazing that both of you went through that at the same age, to imagine that there's another human being who could have gone through such a profound loss as you did when he lost his father and his brothers in that plane crash and in your most recent podcast. Yeah. So I'll play just one part of that.
The day I was one day older than my father ever was, it was the first day of a break off of the show. I had a week off. And so I thought, God, what would my dad want to do? Hmm. What can I do that my dad never got to do? And I thought, well, he'd want to see us, I think. If he's anything like me, he'd want to see his children. So I just showed up. I had lunch with each of them. I just showed up. I went to one college, I went to another college, like I flew around the country, and then went out and did something with my son who was still at home. And none of them asked me why I was there.
Somehow it's that last sentence that really brings it home. I mean, so what, you did this for you and for your heart, and yet you have touched something in so many people already.
Yeah.
How do you decide how you're going to chart your course through this podcast for what you do next?
Yeah, I'm still making them. I mean, I've recorded a new one comes out tomorrow. It's about my brother's death by suicide when he was 23. He killed himself in front of my mother.
And I talked to a palliative care doctor named Dr. B.J. Miller, who's just extraordinary. His sister Lisa died by suicide. And he sat by the beds of hundreds of people who have died. And he, you know, I wanted to talk to people like Stephen who are profound and have thought about loss and grief to kind of help me and listeners rethink, you know, hear something that helps them rethink or reframe the loss. You know, we all have these stories that we've narrated to ourselves over the years. God knows I have over 55 years of my life, you know, about, well, I'm profoundly impacted by grief and these are my losses and I carry them with me. But you can change that narrative. You can change those stories. And I think that's something that's really powerful. And loss and grief is something we don't talk enough about. No. It is, all of us will experience it. It is among the most universal of human experiences. And yet we feel isolated and alone in it and lonely in it. And there is another way, and I think it's great to hear people in public life talking about it and to hear some of the people in this podcast I get to talk about it.
Anderson, thank you so much.
Thanks for doing it.
It was really nice to talk to you about it. And, of course, all there is with Anderson Cooper, you can find it. Just scan the QR code right now. You can see it on the bottom below me on the screen.
I don't know how that works. It's crazy to me.
You just hold your phone up.
I know. It's technology.
And the new episode that Anderson just mentioned will be out tomorrow morning. And next, new images of the moment that you saw live last night, that NASA spacecraft crashing into an asteroid. We actually have now the pictures, the images of the moment. And finally tonight, that moment of impact. New images revealing what we witnessed live last night, right, which was that NASA aircraft, a spacecraft crashing into an asteroid to try to knock it off course. So here's what it looked like from satellite. You can actually see the asteroid and see the collision. There it is. That's a massive collision. More images. You see the blast in the background. The larger asteroid, Didymos, is in the foreground. Dimorphos is the one in the back that it hit. It was a $300 million project, and the whole goal is to see if NASA can hit something really tiny and knock it off course so that we wouldn't have a catastrophe for human civilization. Thanks for joining us, and now let's hand it off to Anderson.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking. Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.